tonight on Arena. Liam Mwainley and Diarmaid DeFuiche speak to us ahead of tonight's performance of O Row in An Chiathrú Rua. And actor and comedian Bill Murray turns 70 today. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. O Row, a new theatrical production, opens tonight in An Chiathrú Rua as part of Galway 2020. The show encompasses music, dance, drama and song and brings together the talents of 10 performing artists from around Europe, all of whom work predominantly in their various native languages, which include Irish, Gaeilge, Scots Gaelic, Frisian and Cornish. The work is the brainchild of Dara Machanumara, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined now from An Chiathrú Rua by two of the artists taking part in this evening's performance, so I'm delighted they're with me as well, musician Liam Mwainley and actor Diarmaid DeFuiche. Garamila Mahagotha Svetla Manocht Echarja. Start with you, Diarmaid. I've said dance, I've said drama, I've said song, I've said music, but I'm trying to really get a handle on what exactly it is you're performing. Can you describe what you think it is?
We regretted to include lighting and costume as well, because they're all actually elements in it, and even the building itself. What we did is we came together, it's a site-specific piece, and we came with certain ideas, but then the space itself started to impose its own view. We went with that. And so no, it's not theatre, it's not a concert, it is not a contemporary dance piece, it's all of the above, and I think more, it's a ballad, it's a story of migration, a story of home, of what it is to seek home and to find home, and that is told through all those disparate elements. And I think a lovely part of it has been that we've had the lighting designer in it from day one, so in the rehearsal room with everybody else contributing, that really has given it a certain flavour.
Yeah, that gives it a very different thing when all of those elements are there from the very beginning and everything is developing together. It becomes quite often something that's bigger than the whole, that's bigger than the sum of the parts. Diarmaid mentioned to me there, Liam, about the building. Where have you been rehearsing and where is the performance? Where is the performance going to take place?
There's a Monaghan, there's a factory in Tismon in Carrarua, and it would have been a Gaeltara factory where they made the jumpers not so long ago, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And it's a fabulous big factory, and our mission was to fill it with theatre. And theatre through music, theatre through dance, theatre through words, theatre through movement, and as Diarmaid says, theatre through the building itself. There's a vast area, and then there's a number of smaller rooms. We are using most of that space, really.
So it's not a case of, and I know it's a small audience because of these COVID days that we're living in. It's a big space, but it's a small enough audience. I think somewhere in the region of 33, I think people will be there with you. So it's not just sit down and watch this happening in front of you. Do you bring the audience around the building into the different rooms, Liam?
That's kind of how, keeping the building always in mind and keeping the limitations in mind as well. All of these things kind of added a sharpness to the making the chink not too wide, if you know what I mean. We bring the people through. So there's movement. The audience move 3 or 4 times during the piece. But
my understanding is, Liam, that on the first morning of rehearsals, that you went into this wonderful, it sounds like a wonderful space, which probably carries a whole bundle of history and atmosphere with it from what you've told me already. But you went in, Dara Machanumara had basically sold some kind of scenario to you guys. I'm not sure exactly what. But you were starting from a pretty empty base, which is scary, but liberating, I guess, in some ways too.
Most of those involved were in touch via Zoom, and there was chats and stuff, but nothing could really be set in stone until you dipped your oar in the water kind of thing. I arrived on the third day, and there were 3 or 4 little scenes that were being just created, let's talk. There'd be an amount of talk, and then Darach had different groups of us go out into different rooms together and just create something. And it was a very simple method in a way, and it made the afternoons actually very enjoyable. There was something that was quite exciting, because you wouldn't know what anyone would come up with. But having said that, we did not know how things were going to become cohesive until until Dara basically looked at everything that had been done and put them up all up on the wall and started moving them around until it looked like we had a beginning to an end. And you know, then music obviously is the abstract element that allows allows ponderance, allows reflection.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there's beautiful literature in the work. There's Cornish, there's Gaeilge mostly, and there's Gaelic. Sometimes you're hearing languages that you might not understand. And so it's very much about what you see. And then the lighting, as Diarmuid again was saying, that he was involved in the jam. You know, he was involved in the creation as well as we were going. And he was handing out lights on these days of experimentation so that we could touch upon the feeling that was being created by the whole production, as opposed to just having everything built and then lights been put on top of it.
Yeah.
And costume being put on top of it and all the rest.
I want to listen to a piece that you sent up to us, a recorded piece. This is called Gribbin Rocks. Diarmuid speaks Osqueligi in the midst of this. If the world's going to fall about us, it will fall, I suppose. If the planet will crumble, it will crumble. So obviously environmentalism is part of the story here. But where does the poem come from, do you know, Liam?
Yeah, Josie Duncan is the most amazing singer, and she's from Lewis, the island of Lewis, in the Western Isles of Scotland. The poem was written by her grandfather. Every generation faces some kind of obscurity. And I mean, especially if you were, say, you're on the receiving end of an empirical agenda, you're going to face adverse ways being imposed upon you. And culture and identity of self and identity with each other through language is often the thing that sustains us. That's what I get from the poem.
So Josie, who's part of the production, and then it was her her grandfather, as you said, who wrote the poem. Then we'll hear you, we'll hear Liam, we'll hear Diarmuid speaking at Osqueligi. We'll hear yourself on piano in the midst of this, and the piper, Alana McGuinness, is there
playing
as well.
And she created this slow air. It's a thing. The thing about the pibroch in Scotland is that it's a bit like the raga in India. It's a more of a modal expression than a defined song or tune. So she goes into a mode and she plays for X amount of time, and that becomes the tune.
Right, well, let's have a listen to how that all sits together then. And that's a piece called Gribbin Rocks, and you heard the voice there, the speaking voice of Diarmuid de Fuaiche, the piano playing of Liam O'Mahony, and beautiful piping there from Alana McGuinness. Alana is part of the show as well, Diarmuid. I think we have your phone back now. Alana is part of the performing aspect here as well, is she?
Oh, absolutely. And again, I suppose it shows you that the type of event that it is, that Alana, who's in the production office when she's not in rest, is also fully involved and has been from day one. And I found it a wonderful way to work, really, and to have everybody's tuppence halfpenny thrown in.
Yeah. It's certainly. I have to say, it sounds like a very interesting project. We're still having a slight problem with your phone, so I'll just finish up with Liam, if I could. Liam, this has been very well funded, obviously, to be able to get these artists from various parts of the world. There's a Frisian painter and poet in there as well, Anne Fadema, which is Belgium, Holland, that kind of region. Is that what we're talking about?
The Northern Netherlands.
Oh, so it's even further north than that. The northern part of the Northern Lands, if you like.
Netherlands, In fact, I was there, funnily enough, and I have a hat from the town that Anna is from.
Well, that should be part of your costume, I hope. But it sounds like a most interesting project. Listen, Gnairí Livanacht, best of luck for this evening's performance, Liam, and Garamatha Svetling and Garamatha got the GM at the Freshen. The guys are literally running off to go on stage in the next while, so we'll let them go with that. O Row will be performed a limited run at Gallery on Tismon, as we were told there. This is a large factory turned theatre in an Chiachra Rua, Cunamara Gaeltacht Cunamara. Starting tonight, culminating on the European Day of Languages. That's on the 26th of September. Difficult to get tickets, but worth checking it out. You can check it out on the website, which is alain.ie. Friday next, the Donegal Bay and Bluestacks Festival begins and it runs through until October the 18th. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the festival dates have been extended to avoid a concentration of events, and the programme will include a blend of live and pre-recorded online performances. Live performances will take place at the Abbey Arts and Cultural Centre in Ballyshannon and at the Ballor Arts Centre in Ballybuffet, while online events will obviously be available through the website donegalbluestack.com. I'll give that again before the end of the item. One of the events is a play on the life of Sister Catherine Black, a Remelton nurse who went on to care for King George of England. Maggie Hannan is the author of Sister Black. She joins me now from the rehearsal space, I believe, in the Abbey Arts and Cultural Centre. Sister Black, Maggie, this woman is a one-woman show written and performed by yourself on the life of this Remelton woman, Catherine Black. How did you hear about her?
Well, I was running classes in Remelton Town Hall, and there's a poster on the wall in there, and Jean, the woman that runs the hall, she showed me this poster, and there's all these famous people that came from Remelton, and Catherine Black was the only woman on the poster, and she told me that she had a memoir, and it was in the library in Letterkenny, and that I should read it. So I read it, and it was an absolutely beautiful book. Mm. And I just, it inspired me to kind of make the show about this woman.
Well, she certainly had an eventful life. There's no doubt about that. She was born in Remelton near the turn of the 20th century.
Yes, she was born in 1878. And she was born to a fairly prosperous family in Remelton. Her father, Moses Black, ran a drapery. And her mum was brought up in America. So she had this conflicting upbringing between a very straight and strict Presbyterian and a kind of more New World influenced mum.
Yeah, because I suppose the name Moses Black might give us a suggestion there that the Bible played a large part in the father's life.
Absolutely, yes, it did. yeah, it did.
Anyway,
they all went to church in the Presbyterian, where Francis McAmey was a preacher in the church that they went to.
Ah, right. And her parents then, they ran a drapery shop and they wanted her to stay at home and mind the younger children. But she had other ideas.
She did. She was very single-minded, and she saved her pocket money and she went to Dublin to interview. But she failed at the interview.
And what was she interviewing for at that point?
Oh, as a probationer, as a nurse student. Mm.
So nursing was there from the very beginning in her mind.
It was, yeah. Well, she wanted either to write a novel or to be a nurse, but the nursing persisted. Yeah. So she went to Dublin, and she was turned down. But she had this subscription to a magazine called the Hospital Magazine, and that page had one page for nurses. And she knew there'd be a list of hospitals then in England that would accept probationers without interview. So she wrote to them, and she had a photograph taken that made her look mature and sent it all off. And she was accepted. And so then that's how she went off, yeah.
And obviously this is where a lot of the experiences in and around World War One happened. Did she actually experience soldiers coming home while she was in London, or did she travel to war-torn regions?
She volunteered when the war started in 1914, and then she was actually on standby, and then she was drafted in 1916, and she went to France. So she worked on the front line in France in the casualty clearing stations, Mostly, actually. So she was exposed to a lot of the the horror of war, and she writes a lot of her book is about that, actually.
And a lot of the your own script picks up on some of the, you know, great acts of kindnesses that go beyond nursing, you know, nursing a wound or dealing with the medical difficulties that these young men quite often find themselves in. The little bits that you describe, almost like playing the part, pretending to be a sister or pretending to be a mother, just to give a young man comfort at the end of his time, dying way too young.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the young man that asked her to kiss him before and she says, oh, he must have thought I was his sweetheart or his mother. And all these young men, of course, they were delirious, some of them, and they were in totally different places. And there was another book, actually, that I read, and it was a diary of the time. And people, like a lot of, some of these young men died believing that they were at home with their mothers. So it was a comfort to the staff, you know, that they didn't die thinking of where they were, do you know what I mean? So but it's very moving and very beautiful, and it must have affected them deeply. And that's where I think my play, comes at the point where she is remembering and reflecting, because at the time she focused on concrete facts, on pulses and dressings and all that kind of stuff, you know, just to get on with it, you know. And yeah, so that was it.
It must have carried, you know, we often think of the men coming back from the war and the post-traumatic stress disorder, shell shock, as it would have been called at the time. But there must have been a great difficulty for nurses and medical those in the medical profession who had to deal with that at the time as well.
Absolutely, because some of the stories, like, you can't imagine anyone surviving, you know, or, you know, mentally. Like the story about the German airman, I mean, that is just completely...
Well, just explain what happened there.
Well, there was fighting in the air around the casualty clearing station, and a German plane was brought down outside the station, and it burst into flames on impact. And they all ran forward, like herself and the orderlies and other nurses ran forward. But of course, they couldn't get near it because the plane was on fire. And the two men in the plane were alive, and they could hear, you know, them being burnt alive, you know. So I mean, and the shocking thing was, it was shocking for her, but as well as that, there was this, the other side, and that there was people cheering the British pilot who had brought them down, because it could have gone the other way. I mean, they could have been killed if those young men had, succeeded. You
absolutely.
Know?
So that's war. That's the reality, isn't it?
As if
all of those events weren't enough, she then finds herself working as a private nurse to King George from 1928 through until 1936. How did that happen?
She must have been a very good nurse, because she was... When he got very ill in 1928, he was dying, they thought, you know. And so four nurses were recruited to look after him privately, and she was one of them. And she went and she settled down very quickly, and she became friends with him. And he was a very ordinary man and very straight. So I think, I don't know, I imagine that she... I don't know, saw him as some kind of father figure, but he retained her. He asked her to stay on as his private nurse afterwards, and that's how she ended up.
She moved on. I mean, you're saying that they got on very well together. Does she write much about that in the memoir, or did you have to imagine a lot of those interactions?
She writes a lot about the king and about the royal family as well. I mean, she was a big fan of the royal family, and she does, and she brings him to life as a very ordinary ordinary man, you know. So it's kind of touching, because it wouldn't have been something that I would have kind of thought.
Yeah, we can particularly, I suppose, royalty of that era seemed to be not only at an arm's distance, but a long way away from the ordinary people. One final thing that I think is interesting, you know, obviously there's the time with the king, there's the time that she spent in the war, but also she moved on to Australia there and speaks about the great medical breakthroughs of that era.
She does, yeah. She went to Australia, actually, after King George died, and she was retired, and she was completely lost for a while, because she didn't know what she was going to do with herself, because her whole life was built around work. But then a friend of hers was going, so she said she'd go with her. And the, you know, she was so kind of engrossed in her work, and so and she says, you know, you talk about the sadness of a nurse's life, but she focused on all of the medical breakthroughs that happened in her era. Like TB was treatable, the antibiotics had been discovered, diabetes was treatable at that point, and pernicious anemia, which was a horrible thing, and
and even scarlet fever, doesn't she mention about scarlet fever,
you know,
which it gives, I suppose, brings us right back to where we are today. When do you start performing them? Saturday is your performance, is it, Maggie? Yeah.
That's right. It's the 3rd of October in the Ballylee Shannon Arts Centre.
Well, listen, the best of luck with that. Yeah. And she certainly sounds like an interesting character for a one-woman show. Maggie Hannan there, speaking to us about Sister Black, her show, which will premiere at the Abbey Arts Centre in Ballylee Shannon Saturday, October the 3rd. Donegal Bay and Bluestacks Festival, funded by Donegal County Council. Full information can be found out online, and that's where the work will be accessed as well. DonegalBayBluestacks.com. DonegalBayBluestacks.com. Now, culture may have stalled somewhat in the capital at the moment with the COVID restrictions, but that's not the story clearly west of the Shannon. We've already been to Remelton and up to Donegal. We've been to Onchearroor, Carraro in Connemara. And at the moment, we'll be going to the Aran Islands later on. But at the moment, we also have the Great Clifton Arts Festival, which is running. Druid Gregory will be there tomorrow night at the Station House Complex. Sean Keane will play the same place at the same night at the Town Hall, and on Saturday night you can hear Cormac Begley and Ye Vagabonds, and they might just play this song.
Shoulder and my graft and newland hand. So round the country I do go, I'm a roving journeyman.
A little taste there of Roving Journeyman, Cormac rather, Begley on concertina, and Ye Vagabonds, brothers Brian and Dermot McGlynn on vocals there. And all three will be playing the Station House Theatre on Friday night, and you can find out full information on cliftonarts.ie. Bill Murray, the celebrated actor, writer and comedian, turns 70 today. He rose to fame on America's Saturday Night Live before starring in iconic box office hits like Ghostbusters, Scrooged and Groundhog Day. And he spent most of his adult life in the spotlight with a trio of hugely anticipated projects on the horizon. He has rarely been busier. But how did a sketch show performer go on to become one of the most famous comic actors of all time? And what are some of his finest roles? Well, Chris Watter is here to tell me just how that happened. We mentioned Saturday Night Live at the top. It's something of a springboard, really, Chris, I suppose, for lots of big comedy actors in Hollywood. What about Murray? How did he become involved and be part of that group?
He became a part of that group when he was in his mid-20s, back in 1976. And this was a time in Bill Murray's life when he was still trying to figure out what he was good at, what he wanted to do. For a while there, he thought he was going to be a doctor. He had a huge interest in history and philosophy and academia. And he was taking pre-med school courses in Colorado, but he was quite curious about what his brother, Brian Doyle Murray, was doing, you know, in the Second City improv troupe in Chicago. So he went along and realized, I might have a bit of a knack for this, you know, improvised sketch comedy where you don't have to be too serious. You know, you kind of make things up on the spot. You can basically just be a professional clown. That hadn't occurred to Murray before, and it sort of tied in with this very sardonic and sarcastic and deadpan sense of humor that he'd always had from when he was a child. So he started performing with these guys, and he moved to New York then, where he bumped into a guy named John Belushi. And long story short, the two of them got on like a house on fire, and they started taking part first in the National Lampoon Radio Hour, which then, you know, got a stint off Broadway. It turned into a live show, and then it was spotted by a couple of guys at NBC who had just started developing and indeed screening a show called Saturday Night Live. And I think they took one look at Bill and they thought, this might be a good guy, you know. And also, Chevy Chase is on his way out. He's actually leaving us after a few years. We might have found his replacement.
Yeah. I was quite interested, though. I was looking at an early appearance of Bill Murray and Eddie Murphy. In fact, we're about to listen to the clip from 1981. And Murray was full of energy coming out. The band are playing jumping around and he's going mad. And of course, that's part, I suppose, they're setting up the gag that we're about to hear. We got to remember that Gene Wilder and Chevy Chase and Richard Pryor had been there in previous times. So Saturday Night Live, 1981, Bill Murray is hosting the show. He gets a bit overexcited and then teams up with Eddie Murphy like this.
You're a little excited, you know. What are you doing out here? Tell me, ask me, what am I doing anyway?
Well, you're supposed to be doing your monologue. This ain't the band number. Do your thing.
Come on, Eddie, you know what we talked about. It doesn't matter. What am I going to say? Come on here and say, gee, these kids are great. Golly, they got so much energy, and I don't even know what's going to happen next. Eddie, it doesn't matter, see?
Yeah.
What matters is that we're working together.
Yes.
Yeah? And then we're bad.
Yeah.
You're bad.
I'm bad.
I'm bad.
You both bad.
I mean, that previous black-white act, you know, or should I say that prior act? You know, they thought they were bad, or yeah, wild, or wilder, if you will.
Yeah.
They're not as wild and bad as the Murray Murphy combo, because we're bad.
That's right, we bad.
That's right. In fact, we're badder.
We bad. You mean we more bad.
And we're both Irish, too. That's so great.
And
Murray and
bad.
Murphy.
That's
the
right.
Irish are bad, man. You know, wow, an Irish jig. Let's do it, man.
Now, that's bad and dangerous. So watch.
There you go. The two Irishmen, Eddie Murphy and Bill Murray, in that scene from Saturday Night Live, 1981. And a reference there, obviously, to the Pryor act and the Wild and Wilder, Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor, Chris Wasser. They were trying to replace them effectively, or that's what they wanted to think they were doing, yeah?
They really were, yeah. And I think also in 1981, I mean, at that stage, Bill Murray had walked away as a regular on Saturday Night Live. In 1979, he got a first taste of what it could be like to be a movie star and what it could be like to head up his own comedies on the big screen. So he left them alone. But like other, you know, Saturday Night Live alumni, you never really do leave that show. And you come back to either host it or take part in various sketches. And you can tell from the excitement there. If you actually go back and look at very early Bill Murray sketches, you're watching this performer really craft and mold the Bill Murray sort of vibe, you know, that sort of grumpy but, you know, kind of lovable rogue. But the 1981 version that you're seeing there is someone who is so ecstatic to be back. But as you say, that is a place of magic, and it's a place where so many gifted comedians have had their start.
And out of breath. I think that's the only performance I can think of where I've seen and heard Bill Murray be out of breath. He mentions the, obviously he's making a joke of Murphy and Murray for the Irish blood, but there is Irish ancestry there.
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah. Bill Murray's mum, her ancestors, now you'd have to go back a few generations for his mum's side, but they were from Cork. And he was, it was actually, they were a big Irish family. There were nine of them, and Bill Murray actually has three brothers, one of whom I mentioned earlier, Brian Doyle Murray, who is an actor that most people will remember as a supporting player at Mad Men, and one of his sisters actually is a nun. So a very Irish family. But his father, his grandfather and his father's side was from Cork. And he does make a big deal out of the fact that, you know, he is a proud Irishman, and save for this year, for obvious reasons, he hasn't been able to, but he's always over here golfing, so he does love to visit.
Yeah, and he certainly visited and spoke with Gay Byrne on the Late Late Show back in the day. And we have a clip of a young Dublin comedian called Jason Byrne, who's allowed, who's been allowed here by Gabo to ask a question of Bill Murray.
Yeah, hi.
Just a question for Bill.
Bill,
I've seen your film Ghostbusters. I thought it was very good. And it influenced me and a couple of friends just to start up our own Irish Ghostbusters, as it's known. And what we do is, we haven't had much luck with people now, so we work on farm animals, possessed pigs and sheep and stuff. Basically,
he's getting interested.
Yes.
I can see, yes.
I got you there, Bill. The question is, Bill, have you ever seen a ghost? And if so, were you ever frightened?
Yes. Well, as Jim said, gosh, you has. As a matter of fact, I saw one just 20 minutes. What's the place called? Rollies?
Rollies.
Rollies Bistro. Do you know Rollies Bistro?
Just down the road.
It was a frightening moment. And I know you know what I'm talking about. A waiter came.
Yeah.
Took my order. and disappeared.
That's Bill Murray. Obviously, well, the improvisatory skills never left him. He'd be able to field that question. And no. He goes on to make quite a good joke of it, but it takes a bit long for him to get there. But another waiter reappearing then with a ponytail and as a woman with his food. That stand-up comedian, how do we translate that then into the film star that he became?
Well, it took a little bit of a while, and you know, we keep going back to Saturday Night Live, but if you look at everyone from Richard Pryor then onwards to Mike Myers, Andy Samberg, Kristen Wiig, it doesn't matter what era these comedians come out of Saturday Night Live, there's a point at the beginning of their movie career where things are a bit wobbly, and they sometimes, you know, they sometimes struggle to find a decent story. And a lot of those early comedy pictures that you'll see this talent in, you know, they're structurally all over the place, but there's something special there. And Bill Murray was no exception. So the first few films that he starred in, you know, they were by guys who were beginning to make, you know, they were written and directed by guys who were beginning to make their names in comedy, like, you know, Ivan Reitman, for example. So you had the likes of Meatballs, Caddyshack with Harold Ramis, Stripes, Toots. I mean, at one stage, even Bill Murray in his fourth or fifth film was playing Hunter S. Thompson in Where the Buffalo Roam. But all of these were very, you know, scattershot sketches that almost got out of hand that were allowed to play over 2 hours. And I think Bill Murray was struggling to find, you know, a decent role and a decent story with a beginning, middle and end. But eventually one did come along, and it was through Harold Ramis, as I mentioned, writing a screenplay on spec with Dan Aykroyd, another Saturday Night Live alumni, and they asked Bill Murray to be a part of it, and that was Ghostbusters.
And he was part of it because of John Belushi's death.
He was part because of John Belushi's death. I mean, it's quite sad and poignant that John Belushi was, you know, part of the reason, or probably the reason, why Bill Murray got his start. You know, he gave him that start at National Lampoon, which led to SNL. But John Belushi, the part of Peter Venkman in Ghostbusters, Dan Aykroyd had written it specifically, as he did with all of the characters, save for Ernie Hudson's character. That character in Ghostbusters was actually written for Eddie Murphy. But everyone else you see in that first Ghostbusters film, they're all acting in parts that were specifically molded and created for them. And John Belushi was supposed to be in it, but died of an accidental drug overdose in 1982. So when Dan Aykroyd got on the phone to Bill Murray and said, "Will you play this part?" It wasn't just, "Look, you're going to make a lot of money here and this is going to kickstart your movie career," but also, "We need you to do this for John, and I think you might want to do this too." And that was part of the reason why he did sign on for it.
Yeah, and made a big success.
They were the
financial
best.
Success, critical success, and a lot of money. But then he kind of blew it all in the next choice.
He did, but I said, look, you know, the part of the reason that he did Ghostbusters was out of, you know, he wanted to do something for his late friend John Belushi, but also Bill Murray started to get it into his head that he wanted to be a dramatic actor too, and he wanted to adapt, and he did so. He co-wrote the screenplay for the film adaptation of W. Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge, which would go on to be directed by John Byrum. Now, he did get the financing in place because, you know, it was looking well for Ghostbusters. I don't think anyone expected Ghostbusters to be the most commercially successful film of 1984. And it was bad luck then that 6 months later, The Razor's Edge, you know, it got financed, it got made, it came out, and it was a huge box office bomb. And that twin kind of feeling of being in the most successful film of the year and being in the worst, or the worst received, you know, it messed with Murray's head, and he decided to take a 4-year break. He essentially retired, Sean, from acting, and he went off to college to study history and philosophy. So it messed him up, you know, that success followed by, you know, being brought back down to earth and being shown this might not last.
The return came with Scrooged, kind of a version of A Christmas Carol, inevitably kind of a television executive version of A Christmas Carol. And it was billed actually around the whole idea that Murray was back with ghosts again, as in the three ghosts that we get in A Christmas Carol.
That was it, yeah. And it was also, you know, look, it took a while for Bill Murray to answer the phone. I mean, one of my favourite stories about Bill Murray, as difficult as he can be, is that he hasn't got an agent or a manager. He just answers the phone when he wants to answer the phone, which has led to him missing out on roles in everything. But my favourite, for example, he was offered the part of the granddad in Little Miss Sunshine a few years back, but he didn't answer his phone, so it passed. But with Scrooge, the guys behind this, Richard Donner, they just kept calling because they thought this could be a great comeback, and we could also belatedly cash in on the Ghostbusters success. So as you mentioned, it is Christmas Carol, but with a Murray and 80s twist. And Bill Murray was just, I don't know whether he was making up for lost time, but also the fact that he didn't really like the people he was working with. He really went hell for leather with this.
Yeah, and let's actually, I want to go to a clip from Groundhog Day, which was the next success after, a big success from really after Scrooge. And I know this is an all-time favourite of yours. He plays a grumpy weatherman called Phil Connors, who keeps going back. He's in this little nowhere town, and he's there every morning. He wakes up, it's Groundhog Day, it's the same day again. But he has a soft spot for Rita, played by Andy McDowell. And here he is trying to convince her that he is immortal, i.e. that he comes back to the same place every day.
I'm a god.
You're a god.
I'm a god. I'm not the god, I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck? You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
Special today is blueberry waffles.
You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking.
I could come back if you're not ready.
How do you know I'm not a god?
Oh, please.
How do you know?
Because it's not possible.
I'll come back.
Doris. This is Doris. Her brother-in-law, Carl, owns this diner. She's worked here since she was 17. More than anything else in her life, she wants to see Paris before she dies.
Oh, boy,
what are you doing?
This is Debbie Kleiser and her fiancé, Fred.
Do I know you?
They're supposed to be getting married this afternoon, but Debbie is having second thoughts.
What?
Lovely ring.
This is Bill. He's been a waiter for 3 years since he left Penn State and had to get work. He likes the town, he paints toy soldiers, and he's gay.
I am.
This is Gus. He hates his life here. He wishes he stayed in the Navy.
Well, I could have retired on half pay after 20 years.
Excuse me? Is this some kind of trick?
Well, maybe the real God uses tricks. You know, maybe he's not omnipotent. He's just been around for long. He knows everything.
Bill Murray and Andy McDowell. You also heard the voice there of Robin Duke playing Doris the Waitress. Others in there too, from Groundhog Day from 1993. That's you. According to you, Chris Wasser, is the best film of all time.
It is. For me, Sean, I've seen this film more times than I can remember, and I'm sure there's a joke to be made there, but I just think it is a perfect film. It is just a beautifully balanced offering of comedy, romance. I mean, because as you said, Andy McDowell there is just wonderful, and herself and Marie spark off of one another as this rivaling but also in love producer and obnoxious weatherman. You've got fantasy in there, you've got sci-fi and horror, the horror element being the fact that realistically, and I say realistically quite lightly here, but look, Phil Connors has to be trapped in that time loop for 30 or 40 years, and that's terrifying. The fact that the guys, Harold Ramis, Danny Rubin, Bill Murray, they took these elements and were able to juggle them so spectacularly well, and that the film flows as well as it does, is just remarkable. And I do find it a bit of a masterpiece, and also one of the few films in Bill Murray's vault from around that time where he wasn't just playing this, you know, altered variation of his own kind of persona. He was actually playing a character with heart, and that's what makes all the difference, because I think there's an awful lot of heart and charm in that film, and I do think it is just a masterpiece.
And he also had a lot of heart and a kind of almost a dramatic role, not straight, you couldn't say it was purely comic in Lost in Translation, the Sofia Coppola film.
Absolutely, yeah. And look, he's mentioned this on more than one occasion that, you know, look, there are many stories about Bill Murray being a bit of a difficult actor to work with, but he has said that the people he hasn't had, you know, a falling out with or that he's worked so well with are Jim Jarmusch, Wes Anderson and Sofia Coppola. And the reason why is because he's actually been reined in by these directors and he's played supporting roles, but in terms of Lost in Translation, that was a lead role, but he's required to do something. He was required on these films to challenge himself, and in Lost in Translation, who'd have thought that so late in his career, the perfect role for Bill Murray would actually be, you know, the role he'd been building up to all along. When he was younger, when he was 26, he was playing the role of grumpy old man when he was still a young fella. So when he actually got there, you know, when he's offered the part of, here's a role for you where you play a movie star who has a midlife crisis and he's lost in himself and indeed around the city of Tokyo, it was perfect for him, and he deserved everything good that came his way on that.
And finally, briefly, Coppola is involved in one of the projects that we're going to see in the coming months.
He does, yeah, very quickly. He's got another Ghostbusters out next year. He's got another Wes Anderson film where he's playing a newspaper editor in the French Dispatch. But the one that I'm excited about is actually coming to us next month, where he plays Rashida Jones' father in a sort of a comedy daughter, drama comedy called On the Rocks. And again, it looks as though Sofia Coppola has reined him in and has written something where she's actually been able to get the best out of him. Because I think in his later career, he's a much better dramatic performer.
Chris Rosser speaking to us about Bill Murray. Happy birthday to Bill Murray, who is 70 today. Padraig Jack is a singer-songwriter from the Aran Islands, writes in both English and Irish. His debut album is called Making Sand. It will be released this Friday, having been recorded largely before the pandemic hit us in the early part of this year. Padraig is in the Aran Islands at this very moment, joining us on the line shortly. But first of all, let him bring us there to the Aran Islands by song.
Some rocks below are landing, making sand out here, and the rocks they see said Rosalie. Long ago they wrote their corrupts here with bones of buried marrow, shared blood with Connemara. We're just making sand out here.
Little taste there of the title track from Padraig Jack's debut album, Making Sand. And Padraig joins me now from the Aran Islands. Where are we, Padraig? Are we on Inishmore, Inishmeon, or as you said it so beautifully in the midst of that song, Inisir?
Inisir, yeah. I'm in the capital of Inishmore, Kilronan.
All right, you're in Kilronan as we speak. Is it a matter, from the way that song plays out to me, Padraig, is it a matter of looking out the window and all the inspiration you need is there?
It kind of is, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, I think from the house here, I'd look out the window, look east, southeast, and I see the other two islands in Inishman and the Cliffs of Moher, and all half of Galway Bay and to the north then. So there's plenty of inspiration around, all right, yeah.
There certainly is that. But even if you weren't looking out the window for inspiration, there's plenty of it around you in the house in various different ways. Your father, Barry Ronan, bilingual songwriter, and your aunt, the poet, Mary O'Malley. Was song and singing, was it always going that direction for you, Padraig?
I think not initially when I was younger. No, I didn't play too much music when I was younger, but it was always around me. And as I got older, I think my brother and cousins were playing, and I kind of learned a couple of chords on the guitar. I asked my brother to show me, and I never looked back really. I started writing straight away as well, you know.
You gave in on the protest against music in the family and gave in to it.
That's it, exactly, yeah.
And you play both guitar and piano. What about the way the writing is done then, Padraig? Is it majority at one or other instrument?
Yeah, it varies really. I'm not a great piano player, so I tend to use that mainly just for composing. The fact that I don't know exactly what I'm hitting on the keys helps in a way, because you kind of find nice sounds or notes and just translate it over to the guitar then to finish it. You know, that's kind of how I do it.
And all of this, the songs, everything was completed well before the pandemic hit and lockdown came at the beginning of, or whatever, the middle of February, middle of March there. Was it all done at that point?
It was, yeah. It was all ready to go. I'd been building up for about a year to release, and the single was out in mid-March, just when things were starting to fall apart or whatever. So, although one thing that came out of it, I was asked by a gentleman, John B. O'Connor, to write a song for a project that he was working on about renewing Ireland, you know, for after the pandemic. And during full lockdown, so I ended up writing a song to a melody of my dad's. And that we ended up putting that on the album as well. So that was maybe one positive that came out of it.
And I mentioned that your father, Barry Ronan, is a bilingual songwriter. Do you write Os Gaeilge yourself, or is most of the songwriting done in Merle?
A mix. I'd say about two-thirds English, maybe, yeah. But I do both, yeah.
And I guess it's nice to have that. It's nice to have that facility for sure. The album was produced by John Reynolds. I suppose people will know John's connection with people like Damien Dempsey, Shane McGowan, and Sinead O'Connor. You cite Sinead as a particular influence on you.
Yeah, I think so. As a singer and a songwriter, I think the soul and the way she sings that comes across, I think, is something that I'd seek to try and achieve, although maybe rarely do, but. I think she's one of the best Irish artists, you know.
She sets the bar fairly high on seeking to achieve that kind of soulful expression, right enough, wouldn't she?
She does.
what is the situation? You know, obviously, in the capital now, things have, you know, there's a big change in terms of the type of things that we were hoping might start to open up a little bit in the entertainment industry, but they're kind of closed down effectively again. What way have things been on the islands?
Funnily enough, even though it's a total big tourist area, we've escaped the worst of it so far. There's been a couple of rumoured cases out here, but generally I think even the West Galway hasn't gotten it too bad either. So so far, thank God we haven't had it too bad so far. But you know yourself, at any point there could be a spike anywhere, and we'll all have to, you know, shut down. Unfortunately, it's Dublin at the moment, but you know.
And in terms of live performance, could you maintain anything during the period, or where was every? Well, I know that your family, there's a pub restaurant, isn't there, involved?
Yeah. Joe Watties, yeah. So now it's been open as a restaurant since early July, but no music. And like in terms of gigs, I had a gig in Westport now last week. That was my first gig back, and I am in Galway and the Roche and Dove in a few weeks. And I was to be in Dublin, but in a couple of weeks as well in the Workman's Club, but we've had to put that back till the end of November. So I confirmed that today. But
and getting back to that gig in Westport, and after such a long break, what was that feeling to actually get back in front of an audience, and I guess try out the songs on the album in front of an audience?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a lot of feelings, really. It was amazing to be back playing, but then I kind of realised I had a full set to fill in the town hall in Westport there, and it was sold out as well. So I felt like, geez, I better deliver here. So there was a bit of trepidation there, maybe, but it was just great to be back gigging, you know, in front of a crowd, and I really enjoyed it. So I want to keep that going if and when possible.
You know? Absolutely, and as you say, we all have to do what we're told, but it would be nice to have a little bit of live performance in the midst of all of that. I want to finish up, if I can, Pádraic Jack, with another of the songs on the album called Matthew, and I presume. Here and then I thought, oh, is this a cousin? Is this a brother? No, it's not. Which Matthew are you talking about here?
Matthew, a man who might have been called Levi, I think, who wrote the gospel, I think, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I think I read a few years ago, I was getting interested in history, and I read that the gospel of Matthew wasn't necessarily, I think, written from a first-hand observation of the story that it told. So it was just interesting reading about that at the time, and it's not a strong a strong thing either way, but so I just thought, well, if that isn't true, or if that wasn't written as I thought it was, then what else isn't? And maybe it was just an exercise in saying that we should question where we get all our information, I think, and these days with fake news and stuff, I think that's more important than ever.
Well, it certainly didn't strike me that Matthew and the Gospels would be a route towards that, but that's exactly what you've done in the song. Listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, Pádraic, and
thanks very much.
Best of luck with the forthcoming album. Let's listen to that song, Matthew, from Pádraic Jack's debut album, Making Sand. Pádraic Jack with the song Matthew from his forthcoming debut album. It will be released this Friday. The album is called Making Sand. You can find out full details about Pádraic's music and hopefully the upcoming shows. All of the dates are on his website, Pádraic, that's with the D and the G, PádraicJack.com. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.